headlines. Afghanistan's president says he is in urgent talks with local leaders and international partners as Taliban militants push closer to the capital, Kabul. Lebanon's central bank governor says the bank is ready to use its mandatory reserves to finance fuel imports if the necessary legislation is passed. And at least 44 people have died in flash floods in Turkey's northern Black Sea region. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani says a remobilization of armed forces is the government's top priority as Taliban pushed towards the capital, Kabul. Ghani said fast consultations are underway to find a political solution to the conflict. He also pledged to fight the Taliban offensive and prevent further destruction and fatalities in the country. His comments came after the militants took over the provincial capital of Lugarpole Alam, which is just 70 kilometers away from the capital, Kabul. Kabul is the last stand for government forces. The group is now in control of 19 provincial capitals across the country. The U.S. and a host of European countries have deployed thousands of troops to help evacuate their diplomats and nationals from Afghanistan.
And I expect that by the end of the weekend, the bulk of the 3,000 that we talked about yesterday will be in place. Probably not all, but the bulk. What we want to be able to do is to get there fast and get there capable and be able to provide as much capacity to the State Department as we can. And our intention is to be able to move thousands per day.
The Pentagon said its forces will be ready to airlift American nationals from Kabul if needed. The UK government also said a military operation is launched to help evacuate British nationals, urging them to leave the country immediately. Moving on, the Lebanese president has expressed hope that a consensus will be reached soon on the formation of a new government. Michel Aoun said a white smoke will soon appear regarding the matter. He blamed Lebanon's current difficulties on wrong financial policies. The country has been run by a caretaker administration led by Hassan Diab since last August. That is when a huge blast devastated Beirut's port, prompting Diab to step down. Last month, Najib Mikati was tasked with forming a new government following the former Prime Minister Saad Hariri's failure to craft a cabinet. Lebanon is grappling with a deep financial crisis, worsened by the ongoing political deadlock. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Lebanon's central bank governor says the bank is ready to tap into the country's mandatory reserves to keep subsidizing fuel. Riyad Salami, however, insists that this can only be done if relevant legislation is passed by Parliament. On Wednesday, the bank announced the decision to stop providing subsidies for fuel imports, saying that it does not have the constitutional permission to continue the scheme. That drew sharp criticism from the government. Beirut insists that the subsidy scheme must continue and fuel prices remain the same. Concern over soaring prices has sent people to fill up their cars in a panic. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, and also Mohammed Faour, economist and a member of the Lebanese Party Citizens in a State out of Dublin. Now, thank you very much to both of you for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Let's begin with Mariam. If you could please tell us more about the different aspects of this whole issue. On the one hand, we have the governor of the central bank claiming that he does not have the legal authority to tap into the reserves that he needs. On the other hand, we have the government that is insisting that he should. So who's right and who's wrong? Is legislation needed or not?
Well, there is definitely a very huge debate here in Lebanon. It's a controversial issue right now on whether there needs to be subsidies that continue or that subsidies should be lifted. There is agreement generally that they want to lift the subsidies in order to fund the citizens directly, especially those who are under the poverty line. However, they did not agree that these subsidies, especially on the fuel, should end now. And that was considered a unilateral decision made by head of the central bank, Sujad Salemi. And this is why this caused a lot of anger, not only among the people, but also among the political leaders themselves. Many are even economic analysts or political analysts are stressing that this proves the extent of power that Salami has in the economic policies of the country, and the fact that he can do something that great and take such a decision, which is very decisive in this country, especially at this juncture of time when Lebanon is in a huge economic crisis and the need for fuel is very high and the shortage is also very obvious right now. So this is why this caused a lot of anger among the political leaders. They're calling on him to stop this. We're even seeing a lot of accusations against Riyad Salemi, saying that his economic policies have led to this issue. We're hearing this especially from President Michel Aoun, the group that also supports in the Free Patriotic Movement. We heard refusals from many of the parliamentary blocs, especially Hezbollah's bloc, that stressed that there needs to be continuous subsidies given, especially to fuel, because, as you know, we are in an electricity crisis, and that is, of course, exacerbating. That is on one hand. You also have the issues related to corruption, because one of the main conditions for the next cabinet is that there has to be forensic auditing, and that would probably target Riyad Salemi, who also has lawsuits filed against him, not only in Lebanon, but also in Switzerland and France and other countries. So some are saying that this is probably one of his ways to use a scapegoat in order not to reach a state where we have a cabinet and that can be used against him.
So, Mr. Faur from Dublin, if you could please elaborate more on the legal aspects of this. Does the governor of the central bank actually need some kind of legal authority or a change in the laws in order to tap into the reserves that he needs to continue those subsidies?
Okay, I think the problem is not really a legal one. It's more of a political one. The governor of the central bank did reduce, at some point a couple of weeks ago, did reduce the mandatory reserve requirement from 15% to 14% in order to free up around $1 billion to finance imports. That's not the problem. And it's problematic to reduce this problem to whether or not to subsidize. We've been living through a deep financial crisis for over 2 years, close to 2 years now. This financial crisis has not been the result of bad policies. It has been the result of policy inaction, of doing absolutely nothing to tackle this crisis, other than attempting to buy time and buy time and buy time. This debate on whether to subsidize or not, and this subsidy policy in general, is only in the context of buying time until the inevitable happens, because at the end of the day, the resources are limited. Allegedly, $14 billion of mandatory reserves are left. Even that is not credibly verified, but let's take it on face value and assume that it is $14 billion. These reserves are ever so dwindling as time passes by, and awaiting for what exactly? For absolutely nothing. There is no financial plan. There is no economic vision whatsoever. We've been living in a vacuum a governmental vacuum for over a year. Not that the previous government was able to do anything. Clearly, they were not capable of doing anything aside from proposing a certain financial plan that did not pass through the parliament. So the key issue here is policy inaction, and subsidies are only existing in as far as facilitating policy inaction.
So exactly, if you could make that clear, why are they buying time? What are they waiting for? What do they want to happen?
I don't think they're waiting for anything in particular other than some kind of foreign deal. This is not the problem here. The problem is that the magnitude of the losses that we have accumulated over the last 2 years at least are gargantuan. They need to be distributed, these losses. For close to 30 years, we've been trying to just buy time and buy time and buy time rather than tackling the structural issues in Lebanon, albeit be it institutional issues or financial stroke economic issues. So the magnitude of the losses have been estimated to be around $80 billion, relative to an economy which is now worth $18 billion. So this is gargantuan. This is a gargantuan loss that needs to be distributed. We know that any loss allocation exercise is a politically difficult and unpopular exercise, especially when losses are so large. And this political system and this political class is structurally incapable of carrying out this very bitter and very difficult loss allocation exercise, because as I said, it's a very unpopular exercise.
I see. Okay, let's bring in Mariam Saleh once more. Mariam, do you think that Mr. Mikati will be able to solve this issue? Does it have anything to do with him? Because we do know that he decided not to take part in a meeting which he was invited by Michel Aoun to discuss this issue with the governor of the central bank.
Well, we have issues related to the Constitution also, because we have a caretaker cabinet. It's not in practice right now. So constitutionally, they cannot attend. Even the designated prime minister, he needs to form a cabinet before he can attend these meetings. So this is why most of them stick to the fact that we have these issues of constitution. But these are mainly also part of the system that your guest was talking about, part of the fact that this leads to a lot of procrastination from the part of the politicians in order to solve issues. Now, Mikati has promised that he could probably try to solve these problems. He says he has foreign assistance. He has promises by foreign sides that they will be given the funds needed by the International Monetary Fund or by perhaps the international donors, as we saw in the international conference led by France. However, we need to form the cabinet. That is the main prerequisite in order for us to be able to get any work done. As long as the situation is as such as it is right now, it seems the situation is going to be, the crisis is going to be deepening even worse. Now, just last week, he did meet with President Michel Aoun in order to work on the issue of the formation. They say, based on the statements, that things are positive. However, we cannot really stick to that and be optimistic, because we saw some sort of positivity also when it came to Saad Hariri in his meetings with President Aoun. So we're not sure if this will lead to that sort of formation. We might see something new next week or not. Or they are, as your guest said, waiting for some sort of a foreign deal in order to allow for this to happen. However, you have a lot of things that play out here, also related to the maritime borders, to negotiations on that issue, that things will not work in Lebanon until we have some sort of a deal in that regard, or we do have demarcation based on the American conditions and American terms. So this is why it is very much complex and very much vague, and it doesn't seem that we can see any light from this tunnel anytime soon until we probably have a cabinet.
So one quick question, Mariam, since you're right there on the ground, what is the situation going to be like for the average Lebanese person in the street? Are they looking to higher fuel prices or not?
They are looking to higher fuel prices. It is already too high. We're seeing gallons of the gasoline being sold in the black market for prices that are unprecedented. We're seeing people line up at bakeries because many bakeries have stopped working because of lack of diesel. We have electricity shortages. I'm talking to you right now as the electricity has been off for 18 hours. So this is the crisis that we are living in right now. We are in the heart of the crisis right now. This is worse than anything Lebanon has ever experienced since perhaps the Civil War. And the generation during the Civil War tells you that even at that point, we didn't have that much electricity cuts or power cuts and so on. So this is what it is like. You have people lining up for bread. You have people lining up for gas. And we don't know what will be next.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Fowler, if you could make that quick in less than 1 minute. Do you think that the politicians do actually care what's happening to the people?
No, I really doubt that they care. If they did care, they would have, at the very least, even though I don't bet on any government from this group of politicians, but if they did care, we would have seen them expediting a government formation, but that's clearly not a priority for them. So no, I cannot see them caring whatsoever, keeping in mind that this is not a question of whether or not they care, whether or not they're capable, and they are structurally incapable of doing anything.
Thank you very much. Interesting point. Mohamed Faour, economist and member of the Lebanese Party Citizens in the State, and our very own correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, joining us live. Thank you for your comments. Moving on, the death toll from the flash floods on Turkey's Black Sea coast has risen to 44. Authorities have declared Kastamonu the worst-hit province, so where 36 people have lost their lives. Eight others also died in Sinop and Bartin provinces. Eight people are also believed to be buried under the rubble. Torrential rain and subsequent flooding have forced some 1,700 residents in Turkey's Black Sea provinces to evacuate their homes. The floods have destroyed homes and bridges and left hundreds of villages without electricity. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has declared the flood-hit regions as disaster areas. The floods are among the worst the country has experienced to date. A Russian firefighting airplane has crashed into a mountain in Turkey's southern region of Marash. The aircraft was carrying five Russian servicemen and three Turkish citizens. All the people on board have been pronounced dead. A Russian commission has been dispatched on the crash site to determine the cause of the accident. The B-200 plane had been involved in fire extinguishing efforts near the city of Adana. Turkey's wildfires broke out in late July, scorching tens of thousands of hectares of forest. The blazes have killed at least nine people. Authorities say flames have come fully under control. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Muharram Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Freedom has multiple meanings. The simplest meaning of the word is to get rid of confinements and whatever limits one's movement or freedom of action. In this respect, freedom is the opposite of slavery. Yet, it has a broader meaning which refers to the freedom of spirit and inward freedom. In other words, true freedom means to stick to one's belief and values no matter what it costs. This level of freedom liberates one of humility and submission to tyrants and despots. It also liberates one of carnal desires and material ambitions. This level of freedom makes one free-spirited. As a matter of fact, the climax of humanity is to worship God and servitude of God. Hussein is the role model of free-spirited people in the world. He was the son of Imam Ali and Lady Fatima and the younger grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon them. According to Imam Hussein's school, getting released of the servitude of all but God is the zenith of spiritual freedom. The Master of Martyrs is the top symbol of freedom, not only for Muslims, but all other freedom seekers in the world. Mahatma Gandhi was boastful of reading the history of Karbala and learning the lesson of freedom from Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Hussein's school has trained great students throughout history. The martyrs of eight-year Iraq-Iran war were among the prominent of those students. These men followed in the footsteps of Imam Hussein and stood against the armed-to-the-teeth enemy with bare hands and liberated their soil and defended their compatriots by sacrificing their lives. Imam Hussein was the fifth among the Ahlul Bayt, or the progeny of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Ahlul Bayt were the people on whom the Prophet said that whoever sticks to them will never be misled. He was invited to take oath of allegiance to Yazid, the licentious son of Muawiyah, who was notorious for womanizing, drinking, and playing with monkeys. Imam Hussein said several times that he would never accept the humility of allegiance to such a corrupt man. During the Karbala battle, the Imam tried his best to awaken the people who had accepted the contemptible service of Yazid. He said in a sermon, "Is there no free-spirited man to leave this half-eaten world for its people your beings cost no less than paradise. So, do not sell them except for paradise. Imam Hussein's warnings awakened few men of the enemy's hordes. One of them was Hur, son of Yazid Riyahi. He was one of the commanders of Yazid's troops. He repented and fought for Imam Hussein till he sacrificed his life for the Imam and his lofty values. On the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, after sealing the argument for the hordes of Yazid, decided to fight against the illegitimate and corrupt Umayyad regime. This free-spirited and kind-hearted leader invited the enemy to God and freedom till his last breath. When he had sustained countless injuries and had no power to stand, he saw that the unmanly enemies were heading toward the tents. Therefore, he stood on his knees and cried out, "If you have no religion, at least be free-spirited in your world." He meant that even if they do not believe in God and his messenger, at least they should adhere to the tradition of their forefathers, who would not seize the properties of the enemy before defeating him. As a matter of fact, this had been the tradition of Arabs since old times, and the Imam was reminding of their traditions. Imam Hussein was reminding them of not assaulting the women and properties while he was alive. Imam Hussein stood against the corrupt Umayyad regime and didn't capitulate to the godless tyrant Yazid. That's why he has become famous as the Lord of the Free. He preferred freedom of spirit to life under oppression and humility.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Africa Today. Tunisia, which is touted as a success story of the 2010 Arab Spring or the Islamic Awakening movement, is facing a political crisis after President Kais Saied suspended parliament for at least a month. He also fired the prime minister amid protests over rising COVID-19 cases and a struggling economy.
The president of the republic will take charge of the executive power with the help of the government, which will be headed by a new leader appointed by the president of the republic.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place across Africa. In the first part of our program, we are focusing on the recent political events in Tunisia. And in the second segment of our program, we shall be talking about how the Israeli regime has infiltrated the African Union and obtained observer status. This move has been opposed by a strong bloc of African countries and masses across the continent. Now stay with us till the end of our show as we analyze these subjects.
Tunisia, political crisis. Tunisia's President Kais Saied announced exceptional measures on the 25th of July, initially for 30 days, but open to extension. Let's take a listen to the president announcing some of the decisions he has taken.
The first decision is to freeze all the powers of parliament. The second decision is to lift the immunity of all members of parliament. The third decision is that the president assumes the executive authority with the help of a prime minister appointed by the president of the republic.
This announcement by the president plunged Tunisia into a political turmoil. His opponents accuse him of having staged a coup, but Saied has said his actions are justified under the constitution, which allows the head of the state to take unspecified exceptional measures in the event of an imminent threat.
The head of Tunisia's biggest party, the Islamic Ennahda party, Rashid Ghannouchi, who is also parliament speaker, has accused President Saied of a coup when he declared he was seizing executive authority. Now, for more on the situation in Tunisia, we contacted Elijah Magnia, a journalist and political analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first, was the move by President Saied expected, or in other words, was it a surprise?
Well, actually, it's not very surprising because of the state and the country that was developing since the summer 2020, the corruption, the mismanagement of the government in place, and also the consequences of the COVID when the Tunisian population, only 7% of the population has been vaccinated. So the president took advantage of the Tunisian constitution. He is someone who understands very well the law. And in according to the 2014 constitution, Article 80, it gives him, in the event of imminent danger threatening the nation's institution or the security or independence of the country, he has the right to call the state of emergency.
Now, Mr. Magnia there says that the Tunisian president acted according to the constitution. President Saied, a constitutional lawyer, has also reiterated that he acted according to the constitution of Tunisia and rejected accusations that his action amounts to a coup.
I have taken responsibility. I am taking a historic responsibility. Those who claim this matter is related to a coup need to revise their lessons in the constitution.
Some Tunisians celebrated the president's controversial decision, while others condemned the move, saying it's a return to dictatorship. Let's take a look at the mixed reactions by protesters.
The decisions by President Kais Saied are not correct, against the constitution and reality. They bring us back once again to 1954. To see parliament closed by tanks is disgraceful.
Now, crowds in Tunis and elsewhere in the country immediately celebrated the president's move, while some condemned the decision. Now, are such mixed reactions an indicator that the society is polarized?
We can't forget that Tunisia was the first country who started the Arab Spring. It's a country that's very much alive. with a population that's very much aware of what's happening in their country, and they immediately react to it. This is why people were happy, because they see in the president someone who wants to put the country back on track and to stop corruption and do something about it. And he already claimed that there are many people who stole a lot of money from the country, from the ministries, and this is why people liked it.
Tunisia's Ennahda party has called on President Saeed to engage in dialogue to avoid deepening the country's political crisis. Party leader Rashid Qanouchi, who has led Ennahda for decades, stood for election for the first time in 2019, winning a parliament seat and becoming the speaker. He now says they are going to use peaceful means to pressurize the government.
We are going to try to use all peaceful means, dialogue, negotiations, street pressure, pressure from organizations, internal and external pressure, to bring back democracy.
Ennahda has called for political talks to resolve the current crisis. Is dialogue an option for the president?
The president is not closing the door of the dialogue. On the contrary, he is saying that he is listening to his people and he's listening to the political parties. But because Ennahda is in charge and has a lot of power in the government and in the parliament, therefore its responsibility is according to its size. And because the government has been misdealing with the situation in the country, therefore Ennahda is responsible and should be accountable for what is happening in Tunisia.
The announcement by President Saeed that he is assuming executive authority with the assistance of a new prime minister is seen by some as the biggest challenge yet to the democratic system Tunisia introduced following a 2011 revolution that ousted former Western-backed ruler Zine El Abidine Ben Ali.
Tunisia is seen as the only country that succeeded in carrying out a democratic transition among a group of Arab countries that witnessed popular revolutions that toppled their regimes, including Egypt and Libya. Now, is the decision by Saeed in the long-term interest of the revolutionary ideals of the Tunisian people?
Absolutely. When we see people celebrating in the street what President Saeed is doing, it means he has the support of the population and he has the support of the army and the security forces. Otherwise, he couldn't stand a similar move, not even 24 hours. But because the population is supporting him, because the population feels that he might have a chance to do something or to introduce some changes in the country, this is why he has the backup of the population and the security forces and many people, including members of the parliament, who are standing with him. So this is why it is a move that needs to be looked upon as a positive move, and the president is not taking the situation in hand, abolishing the position of the prime minister or the parliament, but he's only suspending it until he sees clear of how to move forward in Tunisia.
The leader of Ennahda has accused the United Arab Emirates of supporting the political turmoil in Tunisia. In an interview with the Times newspaper, Qanouchi noted that the UAE was determined to finish off the Arab Spring that has seen long-time rulers overthrown in several Arab countries.
Now, our last question. What's your take on the international reaction towards the events in Tunisia?
Well, something has to be said that President Saeed doesn't have a strong party behind him to support him. He is a man of law, and he has been elected as a president with the support of the crowd in the street and the population. We see the international community dealing with him very cautiously, not condemning what's happening in Tunisia, because they want to see further. Nobody can stand against the fight of corruption. And this is why nobody can stand against President Saeed as long as he is moving in that direction. Tunisia has a very aware population that will react to any dictatorship all to corruption, and the population is giving President Saeed a chance to express himself and to do something about the mismanagement of the country and to fight corruption.
Our guest there says that President Saeed has the goodwill of most Tunisians in his recent drastic measures. Now, will he meet the high expectations of the population? We shall keep you posted on the events in this North African state. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Israeli regime's desperate move to infiltrate the African Union. Don't go away.
Israel infiltrates the African Union.
The apartheid Israeli regime is at it again, using underhand tactics and corruption to spread its tentacles and cover up for its crimes. In its latest move, this desperate regime has infiltrated the African Union and obtained observer status using undiplomatic means. On the 22nd of July, the regime attained observer status at the AU after nearly 20 years of lobbying.
This is while pro-Palestine language is typically featured in statements delivered at the AU's annual summits. Palestine already has observer status at the African Union, and thus granting the Israeli regime observer status is seen by many African countries as contrary to the pro-Palestine ideals of this pan-African body. South Africa and Algeria are some of the major African powers that have come out openly to vehemently oppose the decision by the African Union Commission to admit the Israeli regime as an observer in this organization. In opposing the move, the South African government says it was appalled by the African Union Commission's decision to grant Israel observer status at the African bloc.
President Cyril Ramaphosa was visibly upset by the decision and says his country was not consulted. Let's take a listen.
With regards to the admission of Israel as an observer at the AU, we've expressed our deep concern about that because it's a decision that was taken by the chair of the commission and without consulting the member states. Certainly we were not consulted. We have views because we are concerned about what is happening in Palestine, the continued situation there in Palestine, in our view, militates against just warmly accepting Israel as an observer in Africa, particularly in view of the positions and the views that we have taken ourselves as a country against the state of Israel on this issue. So we are opposed to their admission. We are concerned about the decision that has been made. And as it is now, a number of countries on the continent are expressing their unhappiness and dissatisfaction.
Well, for more on the Israeli regime's move to infiltrate the African Union, we contacted Tshepo Magama, an activist and former member of the South African Parliament. He's also a senior board member and spokesperson of Africa for Palestine. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Now, our first question, what's your take on this shocking decision to grant the Israeli regime observer status at the African Union?
It emerged that the African Union Commission Chair, Mr. Faki, took this decision on his own without consultation with the member states and without consultation with the Executive Council of the Ministers of Foreign Affairs of the African Union. And so as a result, most Africans were shocked. Political parties on the continent were shocked. Governments of the African continent were shocked. And indeed, as you would have seen from the response of our own government, our government clearly expressed its displeasure, in fact, its abhorrence and condemnation of that decision that was taken without consultation with the heads of state or the ministers of foreign affairs of the African continent.
Algeria has taken vigorous steps with several African countries to revoke Israel's observer status at the African Union.
According to sources, so far, Algeria has teamed up with South Africa, Tunisia, Eritrea, Senegal, Tanzania, Niger, Comoros, Gabon, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Liberia, Mali, and the Seychelles to protest against the decision. Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Lamamra says his country will not remain silent regarding a decision that was taken by the AU without prior consultations with the member states.
Mr. Magama, as you stated earlier, many countries were not consulted on the decision. Now, has the Israeli regime used the divide and rule tactic to infiltrate the African Union?
Of course. It's typical of settler colonialists. This is what they do. Hundreds of years ago, they did exactly the same on the African continent. The earlier European settlers, using the divide and rule tactic, to turn the oppressed against each other. And, of course, to break up solidarity amongst the people of the global south. And so this is one such tactic of the Israeli regime. Now, I think it's important also to see this in the broader context of what we have seen in the so-called, Abraham Accord that led to the co-optation of countries in the Middle East and in North Africa, notably your Morocco, and others on the African continent, in trying to get support behind the apartheid Zionist project, in Palestine.
The Israeli regime previously held observer status at the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, but was long thwarted in its attempts to get it back after the OAU was disbanded in 2002 and replaced by the African Union, or the AU. Now, how has the Israeli regime been able to infiltrate the African Union decision-making organs to obtain the observer status after many futile attempts?
What they then were able to do this time around was to bypass the structures of the African Union and then, of course, get to co-opt, it seems. And some are even claiming, bribing the chairperson of the African Union Commission. We don't know whether that's true, but those are some of the allegations that are being made by social movements on the African continent to explain why this sudden change of mind by the AU chair, especially because he knows this is a highly controversial issue. It is a matter that has been resolved on by both the Executive Council of Ministers of the African Union throughout these 20 years and the heads of state and government throughout these 20 years, and they have consistently resolved to reject Israel's observer status in the African Union.
Israel's desperate move to endear itself to Africa comes after the African Union chairperson condemned the usurper regime's bombardment of the Gaza Strip in May this year, as well as violent attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Speaking to French TV, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa also said Gaza reminds him of the apartheid era in his own country.
Well, the situation in Gaza is most worrying. We as South Africans are most concerned because the images that we've been seeing of people being prevented to move around, of their homes being destroyed, of people being driven out of their homes before they are bombed, of the Israeli soldiers manhandling people, brings back very terrible memories of our own history and apartheid, when people were forcibly moved from their homes, which they'd occupied for generations, when their homes were destroyed. So this, for us, is very close to our own suffering under apartheid. And when we see those images, we can't but side with the Palestinians.
Now, will Israeli presence at the African Union have an impact on the continental body's support for the liberation of Palestine?
But we are concerned even beyond whether it will only impact the support for the Palestinian struggle. But we are concerned that already it is dividing the very unity, it is undermining the very unity of the African. Israel's colonial project has only succeeded in the face of division amongst its opponents.
Over the past decades, the people of Africa have turned out massively in peaceful rallies to condemn Israeli regime crimes in Palestine. As recently as May this year, rallies were held to condemn Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
Nelson Mandela's grandson, Mandla Mandela, joined one such rally in Cape Town.
Well, mostly I stand here as a father. My son today is turning 4 years old, Mandela Ikram Mandev. And to continuously witness children in Palestine being shot in the back, being put in prison, it really pains our hearts as fathers, as parents, and also as citizens in the Republic of South Africa that have witnessed such brutalities in our past. And we are here today as a family with my wife, my father-in-law, as well as my mother-in-law, to say that we will not rest until we see a free Palestine in our lifetime. And we will speak against the brutality that is meted out against innocent children and women in Palestine. And that is why we are here united as a family today, to charge forward with what Madiba once said, that our freedom is incomplete until the Palestinians are free.
Now, what's the reaction of the African masses towards this brazen move by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union through bribery?
And other formations across the continent are indeed mobilizing. There are petitions, that are being drafted. There's a lot of online activity that is taking place, especially in the context, the limiting constraint, of course, being COVID-19. And so there is a sense of, there is palpable anger. The anger is palpable amongst our people, in society. And so our people will not let this fly.
Well, the masses and governments in Africa are clearly resolute in their rejection of Israeli regime's move to obtain observer status at the African Union through corruption and other unconventional means. Our time is up for today, but as always, it's been great having you. Let us know what you think about our show by dropping us a line through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.